Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our regular dive into the news. And there are only two stories making the headlines this week. The first is Bolton Wanderers are back at Wembley.
Oh, tumbleweed. Do you mean to say Bolton didn't get an automatic promotion?
Correct, we just missed out. Secondly, the actor Martin Freeman has started eating pork pies again after 38 years of being a vegetarian.
I missed both of those news stories.
Well, those are the only things we're going to talk about. And here to help me walk through them is our head of national ministries, Adrian Reynolds. Good morning, Adrian.
Bonjour, Phil Common.
And our national director,
it's Eurovision.
Our national director, John Stevens. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil.
So let's go straight into the Bolton one. Guys, I'm joking. Let's talk about what you've been doing this week. So, John, you've been abroad, Northern Ireland.
No, not abroad. It's part of the UK. I've been over in Northern Ireland.
Overseas.
I was speaking at a minister's fraternal conference, a kind of a regular gathering. A range of ministers from different backgrounds, kind of Presbyterians, Baptists. Our one FIEC church pastor was there as well, which was
great. Welcome
to catch
church.
Church. Actually, really encouraging to hear about them. Jonathan was telling me that they've seen 20 conversions since COVID. Amazing. The church has grown to about 80 people. That was wonderfully encouraging. So there's a regular gathering for the encouragement of ministers. I was speaking on the whole question of perseverance in Christian ministry. So it's great to be with them. I think I first went to Northern Ireland probably over 30 years ago. It's remarkable how the country has changed in many ways. Mm. I think sort of obviously that was pre the Good Friday Agreement. So you sort of, it's been a long period in which there hasn't been quite the same violence. Some were sharing there is still sort of paramilitary power on the ground. Some who are ministering in really tough places in kind of Belfast, where that's a reality. Drugs are behind sort of a daily reality. And I think it's interesting, Northern Ireland is still a more culturally Christian country than much of the rest of the UK. So in many ways, the churches are wrestling with some of the challenges that I think were faced in the UK maybe 20, 25 years ago. But as in Scotland, secularism is coming through kind of very quickly. So I think people are ministering in a context in which they've got an older generation who are culturally Christian. And a younger generation who are very secular. And that's a challenge in ministry.
Andy Hunter would say that in Scotland, the tide went out a lot faster because they'd held on to the cultural Christianity for much longer. Is there a sense that will be the same in Northern Ireland?
I think it's hard to tell because I think in Scotland, there was a cultural Christianity. In Northern Ireland, there seems to have been a deeper, genuine evangelicalism. So it's not quite identical, but it is clearly the case that the younger generation is changing very rapidly. And I think that sort of for churches, they're wrestling with issues of how to do evangelism, how to connect with sort of people that the methods and strategies that they've used. Some people were sharing with me the challenge of older churches where they've been taught separation. So people have no non-Christian friends and no engagement with kind of other kind of communities. So, I mean, there are lots of challenges in ministry. And I was really wanting to encourage people to keep trusting the gospel and keep preaching Christ.
Which I'm sure you did with aplomb. John, good to have you back with us. Adrian, you spoke at Thrive in the Ministry Wives Retreat in the middle of last week. So we have that middle day, don't we?
That's
where
right.
Thrive comes to an end,
that's
Ministry
right.
Wives starts, and you spoke at the end of Thrive,
so Thrive
in the beginning of ministry.
Thrive is for women in paid ministry roles. Churches set apart for women's for ministry of all kinds, actually. And then the Ministry Wives Conference was the second half of the week. Excellent. Both organised by our two directors for women's ministry, Rachel Sloan and Ellen McGowan. Great times, really. I mean, I was only there for the middle day. I spent the last 15 years of my life going to women's conferences, and I love them. There's great spirit, great way to serve those who are serving in churches. I think they're a really important part of what FIEC do. Really glad they're a central part of what FIEC do. And just great to hear stories, similarly, of people being converted, of challenges and frustrations, and especially churches who are working through, you know, what does a healthy women's ministry look like? How do they care well for a pastor's wife, for a minister's wife? But actually also just great to hear, you know, churches growing and thriving and, you know, steps being taken, I think, to value the ministry of women in churches in a way that we've got to repent of, has been sadly lacking in the past, and the tide is beginning to change, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, excellent.
I've also, I just want to tell you this, I was at a funeral yesterday of the of a relative of a church member, so not related to FIC. And Phil, it was a great occasion. It wasn't a Christian funeral of a Christian, but the person who preached really well. And just a reminder, actually, we talk a lot about strategy and leadership and making decisions and structures, and we'll do that again today. But just a reminder that the ordinary business of leading a church is preaching the word, pastoring the people.
Yeah.
And it was just a thrill to be at that and see that in action. So we don't talk about it very often. And maybe that's because perhaps we should talk about it more. Perhaps we assume that's because, you know, people have been trained in these kinds of things. But actually, that's the ordinary work of leadership in church, isn't it? Is the regular preaching of the word, the faithful preaching of the word, and loving the people, pastoring the people, leading the flock. And so it was actually a great privilege to be reminded of that yesterday, that is the nuts and bolts of Christian ministry.
We don't graduate from the basics,
no,
do we?
Absolutely right.
Yesterday was our local conference in Cambridge. There are still local conferences to come, so book the one nearest you. And we're into May now. It's not long till the early bird deadline for the leaders' conference at the end of June. So do make sure you've got your tickets for that. I had a church leader email me earlier in the week and said, oh, my email had reminded him to book. So yeah, do get booking so you get the best price for Blackpool at the beginning of November. Let's move into some news stories then going on this week. I want to start by talking about social media. So this is something you've probably picked up this week, whereby social media companies are being asked to essentially get their house in order to make sure that children can't see harmful content on social media platforms. And Ofcom, which has got the broadcast regulator who oversees social media, is essentially saying if they don't get this right, they will ban social media for under 18s. So they're basically saying, get your house in order, or we're going to ban under 18s from using this content. There's lots to explore here. First of all, my opinion is bans don't tend to work. Am I right in that?
Well, this legislation has been knocking around in some form or other.
Yeah, the online safety bill is the...
For a long time. I mean, back four prime ministers... That maybe not that long.
I was going to say it's like last Tuesday,
May, yeah, yeah. Isn't it? And part of the problem is just knowing how to enact it, especially age, age requirements, because there are ways around it. You know, by using all kinds of, well, I don't want to go into it. There are technical ways around it, and so there have been problems in implementing it. So we shouldn't assume that now that's straightforward. It's not straightforward. There are often ways around things, but I think some control is useful, some recognition of the harm that online content can do, whatever that may be, all different kinds of online content. And there are plenty of news stories to back that up, aren't they, regularly? Just recently, there's been the story of a man selling poison from Canada and people accessing that and using that in the UK. So it's not just porn. It is porn, but it's not just porn. There are all kinds of there's all kinds of harmful content, and just the way social media works itself can be harmful.
Well, the algorithms basically mean you go further and further down a rabbit hole of the things you've looked at before. So if it thinks you like something, it will push all that content that's similar in your direction.
Yes, and I spent a day in a room with you, Phil, and at the end of the day, it started sending me adverts. Facebook started sending me adverts for model railways.
Well, this is exactly right. Which... So that's basically my YouTube feed. It's just cars, model railway, and Bolton Wanderers.
Yes, but anyway, the legislation's been announced, isn't it?
Well, I shall now know why I start getting Bolton Wanderers.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, at one level, I think you're right, Phil. Bans don't work in that they don't work perfectly, but I do think regulation in order to protect people is really important.
Well, we have a speed limit.
Absolutely, speed limit. You kind of think about I remember the introduction of seatbelts in cars, all the regulations about car safety
seats. And people pushed back on that at the time, didn't they?
The idea that you should have a freedom that means that everybody can just choose to do whatever they want, no matter how harmful it is, just isn't sensible for a society. I actually see that in the Bible, don't you? A lot of regulation in the Old Testament law is basically about protecting society because people don't necessarily do the right thing.
Yeah, so you build a balcony on your roof.
Wisely. Yeah. But I think in social media, it is clear that what this is doing is it's controlling the way that the social media companies develop their algorithms. And again, it's a recognition of the power that they actually have. We shouldn't forget, this is not about sort of whether people can freely choose to access things on social media. The social media companies are designed to send things in your direction because basically that's their business model. So their algorithms are choosing what you get to see. They have a sort of a significant power in that regard. Government is basically requiring them to make sure that they use their algorithms so that harmful material, particularly pornography, self-harm and violence, are not seen by those who are younger. So there's going to be a ban on social media for those under 13. The idea is that the companies are responsible for making sure that people don't get to see that content if they're under 18, with a threat ultimately of banning social media if they're under 18. So I think at one level, it's absolutely right that the people who are devising these algorithms, which are all about pushing content to people, bear responsibility for making sure that doesn't push what is unhelpful. I mean, at one level, you might say it's not helpful for over 18s to be able to have access to that material from the perspective of society. So it's a kind of slightly arbitrary drawing of the line. So I do think it is right. It's rather like pollution. the polluter needs to be regulated in order to reduce the kind of the pollution that their activities are creating. That's where a responsibility lies. Now, that doesn't take away from the responsibility of parents and individuals to control their usage. But I think it's an important step and a signal that this is not an acceptable kind of business practice to be essentially devising systems that are pushing harmful content to younger people who might be damaged by it.
I mean, I think it's really interesting because I'm a dad of a young girl and I'm sort of looking at this world she's going to grow up into. And I think there is a lot for us as parents to really take on board and move forward with. We have to teach our children the realities of the world, don't we? And what I find really interesting is I see the way that children are overprotected in society. So they're always sort of helicopter parented in lots of different ways. You know, that can't happen to my child in that public space. So the irony, I think, is we've got parents who are looking after children, overlooking after them, actually, in real life, but then giving smartphones over with no policing at all. And essentially, they can go wherever they like. And I think that's a really interesting concept. It's not how it was kind of 30, 40 years ago when kids would basically go out and do whatever they want dawn till dusk over the summer. I'm not saying, you know, let's go back to those days, but I do think that's interesting because basically on the phone, they might be sat on the sofa, but actually what they're imbibing is incredibly
harmful.
I think
the smartphone has changed the landscape, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's been interesting, I think, just reflecting on the last 30, 40 years. You know, virtually every generation has had this kind of discussion in general terms. You know, when television first became...
We'd all get square eyes.
Standard. Yeah, I remember growing up, you know, when Saturday morning television sort of started as a thing, you know, with magazine programs, you know, multicolored swap shop and those sorts of things, and how awful that was going to be. It was going to corrupt everybody. But I think the difference is there is those things were in the control of parents more. And, you know, although even then, you know, there were big arguments about should children have television sets in their bedrooms. My parents said no. But there were arguments going on. But I think the smartphone does quantitatively change things because it basically moves the place of control and increases the amount of access and puts it in the hands of children. So I think there are different ways for parents to think that there are different needs for parents now to think about how they respond to that rather than, you know, whether a child should have an Xbox in the bedroom or whatever. I think there is a change.
That's why I think there are different challenges. I mean, one shouldn't be naive about when kids went out and played for the day that they were actually doing things that were right and good. You know,
were you smoking?
Not everybody was a Theresa May who just, you know, ran through a field with wheat. I mean, at one level, unsupervised kids and the way that they related to each other and behaved, that wasn't an idyllic world necessarily, nor was it actually a sort of a safe world. So we must recognize there are always dangers at every point. I do think the social media world opens up new dangers. It's that sense in which it is sort of slightly privatized in the sense that you don't necessarily know what somebody's watching, particularly when they're in their room or when they're kind of on their own. And I think in terms of the dangers, again, the government is focusing on the self-harm, the violence, the porn. I think actually the real dangers of social media go way beyond that. It's actually the sort of the constant need to be keeping in touch with a whole group of people, to be curating your life and presenting it on Instagram, to be constantly presenting a kind of an image of success, all of the issues connected with body image and the way that you might appear. For men, it's the kind of, in a sense, following the influencers and the sort of toxic kind of masculinity that is kind of, in a sense, addressing some of the fears they feel about the way that men are being disadvantaged in society and people get drawn into a whole world there. It's the conspiracy theories that shape people's thinking and that lead them to have a kind of an inability to be able to judge what's true and kind of what's right. So I think a whole load of areas which social media is shaping people's kind of lives and expectations, that's actually clearly generating a measure of anxiety, mental health, sort of distress. So I don't think it is simply those very extreme sort of examples. It's the way that people's whole view of the world is being shaped by what is delivered to them through social media. And I think we've got to be very aware of all of those things sort of as well. So the ban won't necessarily help us to bring up and help children to be kind of wise, to make good decisions, to be sort of able to make sensible judgments. Those are the very things that as parents we need to be teaching. And that's what the Book of Proverbs is really all about.
And I think relationships have become disembodied. That's the other great thing that's happened. So, you know, we've moved from the place where if you wanted to play with your mates as a kid, you invited them round. And actually, even in the early days of video gaming, when you were sitting in front of the telly, if you wanted to play video games with your mate, you still had to invite them round.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you can play with anybody anywhere in the world, yeah, online. Yeah. And so what's happened, I think, is relationships have become disembodied. And that's true for adults as well. So if you watch a film on the streaming services, you can have a watch party. You don't even need to be in the same room. Mm. So, you know, John and I might want to watch a war film together, and we might sit in the same room. But actually, you don't have to. Mm. You can watch the same film at the same time with a little camera on you showing your reactions.
Yeah, yeah.
So actually, the whole thing has become disembodied. And for a faith which is all about embodiment, starting with the incarnation of Christ. Well, it doesn't start with the incarnation of Christ, but it's kind of sort of perfected in the incarnation of Christ, and then the gathering of God's people together. I think that disembodiment of relationships has some serious implications.
Mm-hmm. And we see that, don't we, with the next generation in terms of who they're hanging out with, where they're hanging out with them. There's lots more.
I mean, there are positives as well. There are great positives. I think social media allows us to keep in touch with, you know, mission partners and friends around the world. You know, there are all kinds of positives. We mustn't be too down on it.
It's interesting, your question originally, you know, regulation, freedom, ban or not. And that has implications for how we see gospel ministry, doesn't it, really? Because actually, again, in the Christian life, you've got that balance. Is it about regulation, rules and law? Is it about kind of freedom? Mm. And at one level, for the Christian, we need to be people who are primarily regulated by the Spirit. There is a sense in which actually we are changed from the inside. We're given new hearts. Mm. We're given new desires.
Freedom is not liberty.
Freedom is not liberty. Absolutely. No. But at the same time, that makes us sort of recognize the limitations of regulation. So Paul talks about how the law is given for unbelievers because believers live by the Spirit and are being transformed in their character. So there is a goal for us as Christians to help people to become mature decision makers who are led and guided by the Spirit rather than by creating a whole load of rules and regulations, because those, as you say, don't work. Mm. But actually for the unbelieving world, rules and regulations are kind of needed because that is the
way
that people can be protected.
Well, those rules and regulations will be coming from the corridors of power in Parliament. And it's been quite an interesting week in politics, hasn't it? So local elections last week, mayoral elections.
I found myself watching and waiting for a local mayoral election result, which is pretty sad.
Yeah, that's the first
time
for everything.
My family thought it's pretty sad. Yeah, they, at one point, can't we watch something else?
Oh, wow.
No, I'm waiting for the West Midlands mayor result.
And Andy Street lost his seat. That rhymed.
Just 1,000 votes. Yeah, extraordinary,
it.
Really.
But it is really interesting because, you know, the Conservatives knew they would have a bad night, I think. They really did have a bad night, and however it's being spun, it does look like we're heading for a new government in the months ahead. That's what all the results last week point to. John, you posed a question before the podcast. Mm-hmm. How do you lead when you're losing?
Yeah, well, you're thinking about Rishi here.
I'm thinking about the Prime Minister.
I think this is an issue that politicians have to face. Actually, if you look through history, there are usually periods in which it becomes evident that a government is not going to continue in power, that there is a sea change in public opinion or attitude. That happened in 1963 when the Conservatives came towards the end of a long period of a government.
Remember it well.
I think it happened in 1997. Yeah. I think it happened in 2010 after Gordon Brown and the financial crash. Mm. And you get the feeling that it's happening now, that everybody is aware that there's going to be a significant change. And you know, there's a question of what the scale of the defeat is likely to be. But you find yourself in office facing a reality in which you're not likely to win and to be able to continue in power. And I think that does raise a question of how do you conduct yourself at that stage? Do you acknowledge and recognise that that's going to be the case? And of course, you still bear the responsibility of government. And it seems to me that in that sort of scenario, actually, what's really important is that you continue to conduct yourself with dignity and you basically continue to do the right thing for the country in that period of time, not simply for yourself. And politicians haven't always done that. So the great temptation is to suddenly try to do something that you think will change popular opinion, that will give people what they want. There was a famous Conservative chancellor, I think it was Anthony Barber, who kind of, even in pretty dire economic circumstances, gave a mass tax giveaway that led to a sort of a massive kind of inflation after. It's an attempt to try to kind of bribe and win over the people. It's not in the right kind of, it's not the right thing for the government and the country. So I think continuing to do the right thing, even when it's likely that you will not be sort of winning the next election is just crucially important. That's what integrity is all about. And to some extent, I think that does flow over into Christian ministry. There are some things we are involved in a society in which sometimes what we believe, what we think is right, the side of an argument we might find ourselves on, it is evident that that is not going to prevail. And then how do you conduct yourself in that situation? And the danger is of doing things that are purely expedient and pragmatic, that are desperate, that may lack integrity. Sometimes the right and appropriate thing is to keep doing the right thing, even acknowledging that that's actually not going to carry popular public opinion kind of with you.
I think integrity is the key word, isn't it, really? And we need to be thankful on the one hand that UK politics on the whole is not beset by large-scale corruption, payments, bribes, accusations, those kinds of things. What we do see is we see quite, I think a lot of low-scale, can you call it, grubbery? You know, for example, ministers resigning 6 months before an election might be called so they can chase jobs. That's what it appears to be happening anyway, and get around some of the rules on ministerial appointments into external jobs. If you start looking into local politics, I think that I listened to a podcast last week with an expert on local politics who just says when you start delving into local politics, which is hardly ever reported in the national press, it's all very grubby.
Yeah.
You know, it's there's nothing major, but it's all kind of, you know, jobs for the mates and stuff like that. And so I think integrity counts for a lot. And when you do come across politicians who have integrity, we were talking just last week about Frank Field, weren't we? Or last time about Frank Field, they do stand out. And I think one of the things that I lament about politics is how difficult it seems to be for men and women of integrity to do well, to thrive in politics.
So that brings us on to the defection that Rishi Sunak had to deal with in this last few days, which was Natalie Elphick, MP in Dover, who at Prime Minister's Question Times, when she walked down the middle of the benches, turned to the right and went and sat with the Labour Party and had defected from the Conservatives. The thing that's interesting about this is she's not somebody I would have on my list of core Labour values, I don't think.
Penny Mordaunt was asked this week, would she be defecting to Labour and after Natalie's departure? And Penny Mordaunt replied, no, I'm too left-wing.
very good.
Which is a good reply. Yeah,
very good. But I think there is... So that looked like political point scoring. Yeah. There's a question there. So Keir Starmer welcomed her into the party immediately. You know, kind of awkward photo shoot, bluntly, it's what it looked like. He had some pushback within his own party. Should the Labour Party just take anyone?
Well, that's been the backlash, hasn't it? That at one level, she's come over to Labour and has apparently been welcomed. And there has been backlash within the party, both because of the comments she made defending her husband when he was kind of convicted of sort of sexual offences, and also because she has been generally on the right of the Conservative Party. I mean, there are some areas where actually her policy views are more in line with
housing Labour. Would so be one of those.
Was a big issue for her. So she feels the government's failed to deal with the issue of housing. And actually, she's always been an opponent of the kind of Rwanda plan on immigration. So although she's actually had a very strident view about wanting to prevent immigration, she's MP for Dover, which obviously is significantly impacted by a kind of immigration and illegal migration and small boats. Actually, she has not been a supporter of the Rwanda plan and has wanted something much more like the proposals that Keir Starmer has been proposing. So those areas, she's been more in line with Labour. Her overall political philosophy doesn't seem particularly in line with the Labour Party. And at one level, her leaving the Conservatives, that she's obviously disaffected with the government there. It's a slightly different question as to whether you'd be welcomed by somebody else and whether you will fit their values and what they stand for.
She's not creating a long-term problem for him because
she's not going to stand anyway.
So I think the danger here is there some political expediency on the part of Keir Starmer welcoming her into the party?
No, surely not.
Does she really kind of, in a sense, reflect what it stands for? Are the others in the party not really being willing to accept it? The activists on the ground in Dover have been some of the people who have been most angered by the sort of the defection of her. Again, I think it's interesting as a question for churches and church leadership. It's a different context. But, you know, in your church, somebody comes from another church and wants to belong to your church. Do you accept them no matter what? You know, what boundaries do we have? What basis do we have for somebody becoming a member, being welcome in a context? Or somebody who wants to shift ministry from one church to another, they're disaffected with their denomination, they're disaffected with their church. Can they just go to anybody, and should you accept anyone? So again, you know, for most FIEC churches, to minister in an FIEC church, you'll have to agree with the church's sort of statement of faith. You'll have to agree with its convictions on a whole variety of secondary issues and their practices. You'll need to be committed to a sort of an ecclesiology of independency. Actually, churches can't simply accept anyone because they basically stand for certain core convictions, certain principles that they need people to affirm and to support.
Interesting. Well, an election is coming and we will keep an eye on all that happens in the months ahead. We're going to talk in these last few minutes about another kind of voting contest, which is Eurovision. This is Adrian's favourite time of year. He loves Eurovision. But what's interesting, Adrian said before we recorded this morning, what's really interesting is it used to be a song contest, but it really isn't anymore.
I mean, it is called the Eurovision Song Contest.
But you're saying it's not that really anymore.
If you watch footage from the 1960s, rather quaint footage, each country would choose a song and there would be as much emphasis on who had written the song as who performed it. In fact, you'd often get performers from other countries to perform your song, as long as the writers were from the country. And an orchestra in their bow ties and dinner suits would perform it with a conductor would come in from the country.
Sounds like you know quite a lot about the history of Eurovision.
I do love a bit of Eurovision Song Contest, but it was a song contest. In early 1970s, Sweden, not ABBA, but the slightly earlier than that, Sweden started dancing. It's quite corny to see it because the dance moves were just awful. But they started dancing and not just singing. And over the 1970s, it became less about the song and more about the performance. And famously, of course, the ABBA. And if you look at the other groups or the other performers that ABBA were against, they stood out because they were dressed in a certain way and they performed in a certain way. It's quite extraordinary. But by the time you get to the end of the 70s and into the 80s, and you get Making Your Mind Up.
Bucks Fizz.
And the famous sort of whipping off of the long skirts to reveal short skirts. And it was all about the Eurovision moment, and it's now become about the razzle dazzle. So you can have the best song in the competition and not win, and you can have an average song and just completely slam it because you've got a great performance. So I think there is an interesting dynamic going on there. I mean, I like it. It's kind of senseless entertainment, really. But I quite enjoy watching that sort of family viewing in a bizarre way, and we just sort of laugh at the bizarreness of some of the acts. That the bizarre are the better. But there is a lesson there that I think there is always a danger, and there has always been a danger, for church to become less about substance and more about style. And we fight that in a number of different fronts, and we fought it before with music. And I think actually where we are at the moment, it's a much more comfortable place for mainstream evangelicalism with music than it has been in the past. But in all kinds of different ways, I mean, even going back in how buildings were adorned and that kind of thing. I remember, I don't know if you've ever been to the New Room in Bristol. Have you ever been to the New Room in Bristol, which is Wesley's chapel in Bristol? Okay. Very, very plain. Because Wesley really just wanted it to be somewhere where people met, celebrated the Lord's Supper and listened to the word being preached and sung together. If you go to Wesley's chapel, in London, it was Victorianized and made very ornate, lots of candles and stained glass windows and all the rest of it. So I think there has always been a temptation to razzmatazz in church, if I could put it like that, technical theological term. And we've got to fight that a little bit. You know, we've got to be thinking about what is really important. What really counts is substance, not style. Now, of course, I'm not calling for boring preaching. I think preaching should be engaging and should connect with people and should be applied. But actually, if your preacher is not the best preacher in the world, that doesn't matter. And if your music group is not a six-piece band with in-ear monitors, that does not matter. And what matters is the people of God are singing God's praises. What matters is the man of God who's been called to serve in the church is preaching the word of God faithfully. And so actually, substance really does matter, and it matters more than style. And I think we mustn't you know, we don't want to be kind of anti-ascetic, but we mustn't let ourselves be dragged into that sort of Eurovision, the Eurovision way.
It's quite interesting. When Charlotte Chapel bought the old Anglican church that is now their home.
Charlotte Chapel and Eurovision never been mentioned in the same sentence.
Well, the pastor Paul Rees showed me around before they did the refurbishment. And what was really interesting was the positioning of the platform and the lectern, and it was designed for a time before microphones, so that actually the preacher was in the middle of the room, essentially, so the acoustics were the best so that he could be heard when he was preaching. I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah. I agree with that. I think actually substance is absolutely key, and that's really important. The counter mistake is that, of course, what actually began to happen in the sort of 70s, you say, through ABBA and that, is actually Eurovision moved from a kind of a genre of high culture that had been there beforehand, the orchestra with people in bow ties, that was reflective of a particular social era and expectation controlled by the TV kind of executives who thought that that was what was right and proper. And of course, that was actually out of touch with popular culture. So by the time ABBA come with something like sort of Waterloo, that there is a much more of a kind of a connection between the Eurovision Song Contest and the popular culture that's emerging. And they become sort of actually leading pop act of the 1980s. So I think that it is absolutely right that substance needs to be key. But at the same time, if the Eurovision Song Contest had stayed in that kind of 1960s mold, it would have gone the way of Come Dancing.
That's helpful to be reminded of.
Other things there. Yeah. And actually, in the main, despite all of that, actually very often it is a good song that wins.
Yes, I mean, if you have a rubbish song, you're unlikely to win.
Occasionally, there are votes which are quite clearly driven by wider politics, or where you've got something that's novelty mad, and people obviously love it just because of a contrarian.
There was some German heavy metal. Yes. Well, German heavy metal group, wasn't there, a few years ago?
Was it Lordy?
That's
almost a contrarian decision. But actually, in the main, for all of that, actually what tends to win is at the very least a sort of a solidly decent.
Do you want to come to my watch party, John?
Excellent.
So in church, we've got, at one level, actually, it's the combination of substance with how does it culturally resonate with the people
that you're
trying
to
connect with.
Yeah.
And I think that's the kind of the sweet spot.
Yeah. I think the other thing that Eurovision is doing, actually, is it's become a movement in itself.
Yeah.
So it actually has its own agenda. So there's been some Palestinian protests, booing during the Israel performance. You may have seen that in the press. And they announced this morning, the Eurovision organisers, that the only flags that are to be brought into the auditorium are flags of national countries who are performing, and the rainbow flag. These things take on a life of their own. They become a political movement. Actually, a successful church can do that. It can take on a life of its own and become a movement and feel that it has to be at the forefront all the time, and pushing the boundaries all the time. And again, that's not a healthy place to be.
But you're right about normal church. I mean, again, I think we have to think that church is much more the equivalent of a gig in a pub or kind of singing together in a home. It's a much more connected thing rather than a mass experience in a big concert. But I mean, even Christians, when they gather together in a big conference or an event, it's slightly different because of that dynamic of being together.
What a time we've had. We've talked about politics, we've talked about social media, we've talked about Eurovision, honorary mentions to Bolton Wanderers and pork pies. This has been In the News, the FIC podcast. Have a great weekend. If you've liked this pod, do rate, leave a review so others can find it, and we'll talk to you again soon. God bless.